This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
How accurate are the polls? I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
With a little more than a week to go before the Iowa caucuses, how reliable is the information that potential voters provide to pollsters?
On the tech front, Corning, the glassmaker, has a wild new interior display for our cars. That report is later in the hour.
In sports, the signs being displayed outside a North Carolina church in support of their Panthers against the Cardinals in the NFC Championship.
And why that new health tracker you got for the holidays isn't delivering as you hoped.
The more we quantified things like exercise, the more they might seem like work, the less we enjoyed them, and then the less that we did. So they wound up things like Fitbits and Jawbones and the Apple Watch. Actually, for many people, not being the panacea to become healthier.
Stephen Petro at USA Today on why that Fitbit or other device may not be so good for you. He's here in about 10 minutes. St. Louis football fans are still licking their wounds after learning recently that the Rams will be returning to Los Angeles, the second time the city has lost an NFL franchise. DJ Wilson, freelance reporter for the New York Times, says as government officials and residents confront this latest defeat, they find themselves calculating what the loss means and how to move forward. DJ, break it down.
Well, this has been a long time coming, the Rams debacle. And I was at the Alternative Weekly back in the mid-90s when the lease was signed, and we had done a story back then that broke down the loophole in the lease that said if after a certain amount of time, if this wasn't judged to be a top-tier stadium, then they could leave town. So people that were paying attention knew this was coming, but when Kroenke became the owner, and I think it was 2002, the majority owner, he basically... we were all worried that this would happen, and so we knew it was coming, and there was the arbitration about trying to fix up the dome so it would look better and all that stuff, and that kind of all fell through. So we knew it was coming. I did a piece back in January last year that the dodge that they were going to try to do, the governor and the mayor, was to avoid a public vote because there was a referendum passed that said that for any public funds to be used for stadium, they had to come to a public vote. And they wanted to avoid that because they were afraid they would lose the vote because of all the problems the city and the county have with Ferguson and the public schools and crime, et cetera. So they avoided the public vote. But because of the acrimony and the conflict, but because of the people that wanted the public vote, there was a lot of friction there. But they came up with a proposal. It was a stadium. It was a billion-dollar stadium. It would have looked great on the riverfront. But Kroenke wanted to do this a long time ago, and he got his wish.
Well, what's life going to be like without the Rams?
Well, I quote Groucho Marx when he said once, other than the relief, I don't notice a difference. There's been a lot of friction with them moving or not moving. Should we have public money for the stadium? Should we not? Lawsuits back and forth. And I think now that they're gone, I think there's a certain relief in the air, and maybe we'll be able to focus those millions of dollars from the city coffers that would have gone to the stadium each year. Maybe we'll go to something else more productive, like fighting crime or improving schools. Now, there's no guarantee of that, but at least there's this relief that, well, we don't have the Rams, so what else can we do? There's the riverfront section where they were going to put the stadium, 80% of that's blighted. Well, what else can we put there? I mean, there's other things they can do with those kind of efforts. Now, there's no guarantee they will, but that is the hope. I mean, St. Louis is much like Cleveland, Detroit, you know, a lot of Rust Belt cities. We got some serious problems that need to be addressed, and the Rams were, in a way, a diversion.
Got it. We're speaking with DJ Wilson, contributing reporter to the New York Times. He's got a piece entitled, Rams Departure is Another Blow to St. Louis Area and a Chance to Shift Priorities. All right, so... lost the Rams now. You lost the Cardinals before in St. Louis. Will the NFL ever come back, you think?
I kind of think this is it. I mean, twice burnt I hope we're shy. I mean, we had the Cardinals, they left for Arizona. We had the Rams, they went back to L.A., and I'm old enough, when I was 16 years old, the St. Louis Hawks moved to Atlanta, so I remember Bob Pettit, Lenny Wilkins, and all that, so I think we're kind of I don't want to say we're a stopover town, so I think the one thing that there is some movement on, some traction on that we'd hoped to get was a Major League Soccer team, because that was going to be part of the deal with the new stadium, and there's rumors about that maybe happening, and that's more dates than football, and the Convention Center Dome, that now that's freed up, they can make more money with monster truck jams and concerts than they did with the Rams. The Rams paid $25,000 a game to play there. They had the sweetheart deal of the century. They paid very little to play there. And we couldn't book the convention center or the dome for like 4 or 5 months because the Rams played there. So the city may come up making more money than they lost.
How about that? Very good. Very good. Good insight. Boy, that is perhaps the... the soccer city, right, that doesn't have a team. I mean, soccer-rich area.
Because St. Louis University has more NCAA championships in soccer than anybody else. They have more NCAA championships in soccer than Kentucky has in basketball. Because in the late 50s and early 60s, they had like 10 out of 11 years. Now, it's been on the wane since then, but it's still a big soccer town, and we don't have a team. It's crazy.
Very good.
And the last thing I want to say, too, about the Rams is that I think that there's it's a personal note. I watched the Steelers Bengals game, so this was just an ugly game. Then on Sunday I went to see Concussion. So I'm kind of glad to have left town. You know, I mean I have 6 sons, and I kept them away from football when they were in grade school. Yeah. I let them play in high school, but by then they were into soccer and basketball. So football's got some serious problems that aren't going to be solved by a move to L.A.
All right, thanks, DJ. DJ Wilson, freelance reporter for the New York Times. It's 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Did you get one of those fitness trackers for Christmas, like a Fitbit? Are you having second thoughts about how it can motivate you? Stephen Petro at USA Today says it might not be doing what you hoped it would do, at least psychologically or emotionally. Stephen, what have you found?
The more we quantified things like exercise, the more they might seem like work, the less we enjoyed them, and then the less that we did. So they wound up things like Fitbits and Jawbones and the Apple Watch. Actually, for many people, not being the panacea to become healthier. So it was kind of a surprise, and it really mirrored my own experience as well. So I wrote about it, and readers have gone off the wall on both sides of the issue.
So what did the research take a stab as to kind of what percentage of us feel that way after we get one of these devices?
It didn't go into that kind of detail, but the research did show that if you're the personality type, Gordon, perhaps, like the weekend warrior who is very competitive, always wants to sort of increase, get better, then a tracking or health tracker is a great thing for you, and especially if you want to compete with your friends, because these devices can sort of all hook up through social media, so you can see that you did 11,000 steps and I did 13,000 steps, and I did better than you. But for those people who, after using them for a little while, say to themselves, I'm not enjoying this, I'm not having fun, then those are the ones who need to sort of raise that flag and say, maybe this isn't for me. But we're also seeing, there's just, how sometimes in the United States we just kind of follow trends, and these trackers are really a big trend now. Sales are up. There's going to be a new Fitbit smartwatch coming out in March. The Apple Watch is there too. And sometimes we just play follow the leader. And so part of the study's advice and part of my advice is don't do it. Don't buy one. Don't use it just because everyone else is. Do it if you want to. Make that choice yourself. And then you're probably more likely to reap the benefit of more exercise than sort of being cajoled into it, or just that's a pretty color. I'm going to get a tangerine Fitbit. I'm going to get a slate blue one.
But then you can't pretend to be someone you're not on social media.
Well, and, that's a really good point, because I have to say, the time I was wearing my Fitbit, it was amazing how often I would, pull my sleeve back and raise my arm up just a little bit. It was almost unconscious to show off that, hey, I am one of the, I called them in the article, the sport erotic.
Right.
But, I probably should call myself, a former Fitbit nut.
Right.
But there is that kind of like show-off aspect. And I certainly, if you've got some friends who have Apple Watches, there's this really amazing tick that those people have, because that to activate the watch, you kind of need to raise your wrist or your forearm up so you can see it. And guess what? You need to do that in front of other people. Right. So there, again, you're this kind of the show-off aspect of this, and wanting to perhaps say that you're something that you're not quite.
Yeah, yeah. We're speaking with Stephen Petro, digital life columnist at USA Today. He's got a piece entitled "Why That Fitbit Might Not Be So Good for You." For some folks, it's actually taking away the enjoyment of exercise. You know, I realized that a while ago just by wearing a watch. If I go to run, I feel like I have to be at, you know, a certain pace. So I stopped either looking or bringing it with me. And I just thought, all right, I'm going to put the phone and the music on. Let me go run for six songs or seven songs or do a path that I'm not going to know how far I've run, you know, and just try to do it that way. Even just the simple watch was getting in the way for me.
I totally get it. But I do want to put this caveat out there, because I have heard from many readers who tell me, and I understand this is completely true, how much they have benefited from these devices, how it has helped them to lose weight, to feel better, to look better, to sleep better. So, you know, if that is your result, that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, it's motivation for some people, right?
Yeah, and yeah. Ignore everything that those people at Duke are saying and that I'm saying. But if you're in the other camp, you know, you don't need to use it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and go on your merry way.
Stephen Petro at USA Today. 21 minutes now after the hour. New trend at the dinner table. Plates are out. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Bowls are the new plates. Sales of bowls are soaring as we move to more casual one-course meals. With more on this eating and serving trend, the Wall Street Journal's Ellen Byron. Ellen, why are we giving up our plates?
It's been a gradual thing, but more and more Americans are reaching for their bowls, and restaurants and tableware makers are taking notice and seeing big results and much more demand for bowls than there was before.
What kinds of food seems to work better in a bowl? Why is this happening?
Well, there's several different reasons. On the healthier side, there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm around eating more fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, crispy salads. And so as consumers are making more of those types of meals in their home, they're finding that it's a lot easier to make it in a bowl. And when you dig into a dish like that, you often want to have several different flavors at once. And that layering of cooking is so much easier to accomplish in a bowl. And then restaurants are fueling this as well. Chefs at higher-end restaurants like it because they can more closely control what each bite tastes like. If it's served on a plate, it's easier for a diner to pick a dish apart. It also keeps food warmer longer, and a lot of chefs like just the aesthetic value of seeing many components tightly presented together. And then, so as more people see it in restaurants, as more people find just the convenience of a bowl and use it more, the trend really picked up in the last few years.
Ellen, you mentioned the restaurant trend. I thought in your story what was so interesting was the Panera story about how they're changing the shape of the bowl and the shape of the spoons. What are they looking for?
Yes, I spoke with the head chef of Panera, and he told me that Panera is always scrutinizing the design of its bowls to try to make it better and better. And one of the tricky parts about serving food in a bowl is that the cavity of the bowl can really swallow up food, and they're always conscious of how consumers perceive how much food, the value of what they just bought. And he had said the value perception may be that there's not that much food in there, but meanwhile, it's a big cavity to fill. And so they're playing around with different bowl designs, testing different depths. They also have to consider the design of the spoons that they serve, especially with their broth bowls. They want the spoon to be curved enough to scoop multiple bits of flavor at once, and the handle length has to be long enough to leverage cutting larger bites of food against the bowl's rim so that whoever's eating it doesn't have to also reach for a knife, which can be tricky in a bowl.
Does the move toward bowls also have to do with the way we are eating at home and where we're eating as we move away from a sit-down dinner?
Yes, I think a lot of people can relate to how easy it is to put wonderful comfort food like pasta in a bowl, plop down on your favorite comfy couch and watch TV. Many Americans eat meals at kitchen islands, and sometimes they're perched there. And it's cleaner, faster, more convenient often to put your hand around a bowl than it is to try to balance a plate. And then more Americans are multitasking when they eat. So you can eat, scoop your food up against the side of a bowl and use your other hand to use your phone, for example.
Ellen, is the trend toward bowls changing anything else in a traditional place setting?
Yes. The major tableware makers, even at the highest end, the finest china, have been noting how more Americans are eating out of bowls, and they've been reconfiguring the place settings that they sell. So a typical place setting, when you buy a complete set, let's say, before it would almost always include a dinner plate, a salad plate, one bowl, and a mug. Because demand for bowls is so high, they're now replacing that mug with a smaller bowl.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Ellen Byron at the Wall Street Journal. Ellen talks about Rich Brinkman, who's the vice president of retail sales and marketing at Homer Laughlin China Company Bowls, says he anticipated a shift to bowls when sales of slow cookers started surging a few years ago. Calculating that most slow-cooked foods are eaten in bowls. In 2014, they introduced deep bistro bowls in 38-ounce and 68-ounce sizes under their Fiesta brand. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
A little more than a week to go until the Iowa caucuses. Where are the presidential campaigns and what are they learning from past election cycles in December and November? Jason Russell at the Washington Examiner looked at early polls from 2012 and 2008 and showed that they weren't great at predicting who would actually win in Iowa, in New Hampshire, or the nomination. Well, how about now? Jason, what have you found?
Well, basically, I went back until 2012 and 2008 and saw what the polls were saying about who was going to win at that point in time. Because it's pretty easy to say, oh, yeah, well, of course, you know, Mitt Romney was going to win New Hampshire, or Rick Santorum was going to win Iowa, or whatever. But the polls, even 2 weeks before, were pretty chaotic. You know, if you look at 2011 or 2012 with Rick Santorum, for example, he was in sixth place, still with 2 weeks to go before Iowa.
Yeah, interesting. All right, so what does the Iowa polling data tell us?
Well, right now it shows that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump is in first place, but it's still hard to say what that really means at this point. It certainly means, you know, I think if the election were held tomorrow, for whatever reason, that they probably would win, but there's still a lot of time to go. You know, a lot of the candidates have been waiting for these final 2 weeks to just unload all of their money in the campaign on TV ads and all of their time and efforts in terms of campaign organization on these final 2 weeks. And so that's why I think there's so much change in the final 2 weeks before Election Day. So it's hard to say exactly what's going to happen between now and then.
All right. So I was going to say, how do you balance, I guess, natural volatility versus perhaps some inaccuracy, but they may be connected, I guess.
Yeah, I think they're definitely connected. I mean, certainly it has a lot to do with what's going on nationally and what's going on locally. I mean, if you look at in 2008 on the Democratic side, for example, Hillary Clinton was winning nationally for months and months and months, but in the end, Barack Obama kept on winning, you know, picking off states like Iowa and all kinds of other states on his way to winning the nomination. So even though the national attitude was still very much in favor of Hillary Clinton, when it came to the states that were actually deciding the delegates, Barack Obama kept on winning, and that's how he ended up with a nomination, even though the national attitude had seemed for so long like it was going to make Hillary the winner.
We're speaking with Jason Russell, commentary writer at the Washington Examiner. He's got an interesting look at the Iowa polls, questioning in a headline, how accurate are polls this close to Iowa? So does that make candidates change their strategy here in the closing days before the Iowa caucuses?
I don't know if it should change their strategy. I think it just means that they should take the polls with several grains of salt, because it's hard to say if they are, you know, set in stone as they are. Certainly, I think that's why a lot of the candidates who are very low in the polls right now still think that they have a chance. They're definitely looking at Rick Santorum in 2012 saying, you never know, like, we might come out of this and win somehow. Yeah. I mean, I think they still definitely need a solid strategy to achieve that. They can't just sit back and expect that for some reason out of nowhere that they're going to win. But they need to take into account that the polls are still very volatile, and they could change tomorrow or the next week.
Yeah. So what about, say, a margin of error, right? Trump is up by double digits on the Republican side. Does that mean he can comfortably feel that he's going to win at this point, or not even?
Maybe in New Hampshire. I mean, he does have such a large lead there. It's about 18 points that he should feel pretty safe there, but you know, he's so close in Iowa with Cruz that he definitely shouldn't feel like he's got that one in the bag, especially with all the volatility we've seen there in the past. So, you know, definitely, even though he's leading national polls very well by about 15 points on average, doesn't mean that he should think that he has this in the bag for sure. I mean, he is leading right now, but so was Rudy Giuliani in 2008. So there's no reason to think that just because he's gotten all this media attention and is winning the national polls that he's definitely going to be the nominee.
Boy, it's like the only thing you can count on for sure is uncertainty.
Exactly. And I think that's why when you look at all these polls, I mean, I looked at 9 different races nationally, Iowa, New Hampshire. Only 4 of those 9 at this point in time were correct. And even 2 of those 4 that were correct, they still kept changing their lead back and forth between now and Election Day.
Jason Russell, commentary writer at the Washington Examiner. It's 20 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. By the way, to hear a podcast of our weekday program, please visit our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com. You can also check out places like SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. More glass coming to your car. One of the presentations at the Consumer Electronics Show was won by Corning, where the company showcased a car dashboard that almost had entirely flat panel displays. Rob Enderle, principal of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group, was there to see it. Rob, what was the presentation?
Well, what Corning was showcasing was pretty much an entire dash made out of glass. So your gauges, your center console, and the space in front of the passenger were all large glass, almost TV-like panels, and that allows the gauges to be virtualized. You can change them dynamically. They can look like regular gauges. They can look like anything you want. The center console can be for your controls, your AV controls and entertainment. And the new part was, of course, the big display in front of the passenger, which also could be for entertainment, keeping the passenger entertained. And clearly, as we move to self-driving cars, the idea is to, you know, when your car is driving itself, you're going to need something else to do. So have those displays do something that's perhaps a bit more entertaining. You could be playing one of the various racing games while the car is taking you through the traffic. In fact, I can imagine a time when the gas pedal brake and steering wheel decouple, and you use it as gaming controllers.
Oh my goodness!
While the autonomous car is driving you to work, probably keeps you away from road rage.
Wow! All right, so I understand the advantage, I guess, once we get to these autonomous cars. But in the meantime, is there any advantage to having all this fancy glass and entertainment-related stuff for a person who's actually going to be doing the driving?
Well, there is. So if you look at some of the new Audis, for instance, they actually have a display in front of the driver now. Tesla, of course, is the most aggressive. The instrument vehicle is a display, and they've got that huge display in the middle already. And that's to control the car. You get a big map for navigation, so you can see all the stuff around you. And then since they just started to turn on some of the self-driving capability on the central binnacle, the gauge display in front of the driver, you now see displayed the lane markers, and the cars around you. So you can see graphical representations of where all the cars are around you, both in front, and back, and the sides as well. And they come in and out of that central view. So you, even in fog, you're pretty much aware of where everyone is.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. He's got a piece called Corning Moves to Kill Car Gauges. So how much different does this actually look, say, when you're, I don't know, trying to read instruments?
Well, it depends on the implementation. Right now, the binnacle displays, the displays that replace the gauges, really try to make it look like gauges. So if you look at the Audi implementation in particular, you're seeing, you know, multicolored gauges in front of you, which you can change to other things, but they're very familiar. The Tesla is a bit farther apart because they're putting that car display right in the middle of the image. So that's clearly moving well away from our traditional gauges. So they also have the traditional speedometer and in their case, typically battery life on that same display. You don't need a tachometer in a Tesla. But the end result is that I think they're trying to ease us in to these changes.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. It's 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Think you're good in the kitchen? Take a new challenge from Quaker to create the next great oatmeal flavor. It's called Bring Your Best Bowl Contest. Could win you $250,000. Helping promote it is actress Tiffany Thiessen, who you may know from her days on Saved by the Bell when she was Tiffany Amber Thiessen, or as Valerie Malone for 5 seasons on Beverly Hills 90210. She's now host of Dinner at Tiffany's on the Cooking Channel. Tiffany, tell us about it.
Well, we've got a new season of Dinner at Tiffany's premiering February 3rd on the Cooking Channel at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. I can promise you a lot of really fun guests, some returning guests, and some fun new guests, and some people that I know the audience has been wanting to see, and a lot of fun in the kitchen, and a lot of great recipes.
How difficult is this, say, compared to the other stuff you've done, like Saved by the Bell or Beverly Hills 90210?
Oh, it's like a whole different world. And on one aspect, it's very easy because I feel like I'm just cooking in my kitchen, which I am, and my friends are coming over. But on the other side of it, you know, you're having to remember quantities, recipes, cooking at the same time, and talking to the camera. And for actors, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. You want to make sure not to cut your finger off.
Have you always, I guess I should ask you, do you consider yourself a foodie?
Oh, I'm definitely a foodie. I've been a foodie since I was young. I think my love of food really kind of developed as I started touring and kind of traveling to other countries. When I was touring for Saved by the Bell way back when with Mark Paul and going to all different countries, and that was really probably my love of food really kind of started then.
Anything that you refuse to cook? Like, so is there a food you
that
just
I
can't stand?
I refuse to cook?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a long list. I mean, it would take quite a few different radio shows of yours to come up with a long list of things that I wouldn't cook, in the sense of, you know, I wouldn't prepare myself. It doesn't mean I wouldn't eat it, but okay. I don't know if I could prepare it.
Got it. It's not a food you dislike, I guess, is what I was after. Like a
no, there's really not. I mean, when I was pregnant, which I was just recently pregnant, I have a 6-month-old baby.
Yes,
I loved lamb, but I can't eat it right now. Like, I have such an aversion to lamb right now. I don't know why.
It's amazing. I mean, I'm watch my wife go through that, and just the amazing changes a woman's body goes through, especially with stuff like
food. It's amazing what we can do as us women. Don't you forget that.
Go back to the acting for just a minute. Was there a role you ever wanted that you got beat out for?
Yes. My number one top, and that's a quick answer, it was James Bond. I attested for James Bond against Denise Richards, who got it, and Heather Graham, and that was probably one of the hardest jobs that I did not get.
We're speaking with Tiffany Thiessen. She's got a show on the Cooking Channel called Dinner at Tiffany's. So connecting food and Hollywood here, I saw a note somewhere that said at one time either you were criticized or you pushed back against this whole notion of a woman having to be so skinny in Hollywood. Did you go through that?
I think every woman probably has that. But we, you know, as us women, we have our own personal pressures. I don't think anybody else should be putting any more pressure on us about our weight. You know, as you just said, you see your wife going through pregnancy. It's not an easy task.
What does a radio host have to do to get invited for dinner at Tiffany's? Tiffany. Tiffany, are you there? Tiffany Thiessen. Dinner at Tiffany's is the show. It's on the Cooking Channel. A woman known as the Sign Lady at a North Carolina church is drawing viral attention because of the congregation's support of the Carolina Panthers. She's putting messages in support of the team on the church's roadside sign. UPI says the previous sign outside Poplar Tent Presbyterian Church in Concord, North Carolina, drew attention from passersby and online ahead of the game with the Seahawks. It read, quote, "God has no favorites, but the sign lady does. Go Panthers." The sign lady, Dee Calloway, says it was a team effort with other church volunteers. She told WSOC-TV that the messages draw the community in. She said the sign will bear a new message if the team beats the Arizona Cardinals Sunday in the NFC Championship game and heads to the Super Bowl. Meanwhile, the message right now on the sign for Arizona reads, quote, "God loves a cheerful giver." So sign lady says, give the Cardinals heck. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.